Frankie tried, and he couldn't do it. When Doc went upstairs, Frankie crawled in the Excelsior box and didn't come out all afternoon. But Frankie was a nice, good, kind boy. He learned to light Doc's cigars, and he wanted Doc to smoke all the time so he could light the cigars. Better than anything else, Frankie loved it when there were parties upstairs in the laboratory, when girls and men gathered to sit and talk, when the great phonograph played music that throbbed in his stomach and made beautiful and huge pictures form vaguely in his head. Frankie loved it. Then he crouched down in a corner behind a chair where he was hidden and could watch and listen. When there was laughter at a joke he didn't understand, Frankie laughed delightedly behind his chair, and when the conversation dealt with abstractions, his brows furrowed and he became intent and serious. One afternoon, he did a desperate thing. There was a small party in the laboratory. Doc was in the kitchen pouring beer when Frankie appeared beside him. Frankie grabbed a glass of beer and rushed it through the door and gave it to a girl sitting in a big chair. She took the glass and said, "Why, thank you," and she smiled at him. And Doc, coming through the door, said, "Yes, Frankie is a great help to me." Frankie couldn't forget that. He did the thing in his mind over and over, just how he had taken the glass, and just how the girl sat, and then her voice, "Why, thank you," and Doc, "A great help to me. Frankie is a great help to me. Sure, Frankie is a great help. Frankie," and oh my God. He knew a big party was coming because Doc bought steaks and a great deal of beer, and Doc let him help clean out all the upstairs. But that was nothing, for a great plan had formed in Frankie's mind, and he could see just how it would be. He went over it again and again. It was beautiful. It was perfect. Then the party started, and people came and sat in the front room, girls and young women and men. Frankie had to wait until he had the kitchen to himself and the door closed. And it was some time before he had it so, but at last he was alone and the door was shut. He could hear the chatter of conversation and the music from the great phonograph. He worked very quietly, first the tray, then get out the glasses without breaking any. Now fill them with beer and let the foam settle a little and then fill again. Now he was ready. He took a great breath and opened the door. The music and the talk roared around him. Frankie picked up the tray of beer and walked through the door. He knew how. He went straight toward the same young woman who had thanked him before. And then, right in front of her, the thing happened. The coordination failed. The hands fumbled, the panicked muscles, the nerves telegraphed to a dead operator. The responses did not come back. Tray and beer collapsed forward into the young woman's lap. For a moment Frankie stood still, and then he turned and ran. The room was quiet. They could hear him run downstairs and go into the cellar. They heard a hollow, scrabbling sound, and then silence. Doc walked quietly down the stairs and into the cellar. Frankie was in the Excelsior box, burrowed down clear to the bottom, with the pile of Excelsior on top of him. Doc could hear him whimpering there. Doc waited for a moment, and then he went quietly back upstairs. There wasn't a thing in the world he could do. Chapter 11. The Model T Ford truck of Lee Chong had a dignified history. In 1923, it had been a passenger car belonging to Dr. W.T. Waters. He used it for 5 years and sold it to an insurance man named Rattle. Mr. Rattle was not a careful man. The car he got in clean, nice condition, he drove like fury. Mr. Rattle drank on Saturday nights, and the car suffered. The fenders were broken and bent. He was a pedal rider, too, and the bands had to be changed often. When Mr. Rattle embezzled a client's money and ran away to San Jose, he was caught with a high hair blonde and sent up within 10 days. The body of the car was so battered that its next owner cut it in two and added a little truck bed. The next owner took off the front of the cab and the windshield. He used it to haul squids, and he liked a fresh breeze to blow in his face. His name was Francis Almonas, and he had a sad life, for he always made just a fraction less than he needed to live. His father had left him a little money, but year by year and month by month, no matter how hard Francis worked or how careful he was, his money grew less until he just dried up and blew away. Lee Chong got the truck in payment of a grocery bill. By this time, the truck was little more than 4 wheels and an engine, and the engine was so crotchety and sullen and senile that it required expert care and consideration. Lee Chong did not give it these things, with the result that the truck stood in the tall grass back of the grocery most of the time, with the mallows growing between its spokes. It had solid tires on its back wheels, and blocks held its front wheels off the ground. Probably any one of the boys from the Palace Flophouse could have made the truck run, for they were all competent practical mechanics, but Gay was an inspired mechanic. There is no term comparable to green thumbs to apply to such a mechanic, but there should be, for there are men who can look, listen, tap, make an adjustment, and a machine works. Indeed, there are men near whom a car runs better. And such a one was Gay. His fingers on a timer or a carburetor adjustment screw were gentle and wise and sure. He could fix the delicate electric motors in the laboratory. He could have worked in the canneries all the time had he wished, for in that industry, which complains bitterly when it does not make back its total investment every year in profits, the machinery is much less important than the fiscal statement. Indeed, if you could can sardines with ledgers, the owners would have been very happy. As it was, they used decrepit, struggling old horrors of machines that needed the constant attention of a man like Gay. Mac got the boys up early. They had their coffee and immediately moved over to the truck where it lay among the weeds. Gay was in charge. He kicked the blocked-up front wheels. "Go borrow a pump and get those pumped up," he said. Then he put a stick in the gasoline tank under the board which served as a seat. By some miracle, there was a half-inch of gasoline in the tank. Now Gay went over the most probable difficulties. He took out the coil boxes, scraped the points, adjusted the gap, and put them back. He opened the carburetor to see that gas came through. He pushed on the crank to see that the whole shaft wasn't frozen and the pistons rusted in their cylinders. Meanwhile, the pump arrived, and Eddie and Jones spelled each other on the tires. Gay hummed, "dum-diddy-dum-diddy," as he worked. He removed the spark plugs and scraped the points and bored the carbon out. Then Gay drained a little gasoline into a can and poured some into each cylinder before he put the spark plugs back. He straightened up. "We're going to need a couple of dry cells," he said. "See if Lee Chong will let us have a couple." Mac departed and returned almost immediately with the universal "no," which was designed by Lee Chong to cover all future requests. Gay thought deeply. "I know where's a couple. Pretty good ones, too, but I won't go get 'em." "Where?" asked Mac. "Down cellar in my house," said Gay. "They run the front doorbell. If one of you fellows wants to kind of edge into my cellar without my wife seeing you, they're on top of the side stringer on the left-hand side as you go in. But for God's sake, don't let my wife catch you." A conference elected Eddie to go, and he departed. "If you get caught, don't mention me," Gay called out after him. Meanwhile, Gay tested the bands. The low high pedal didn't quite touch the floor, so he knew there was a little band left. The brake pedal did touch the floor, so there was no brake, but the reverse pedal had lots of band left. On a Model T Ford, the reverse is your margin of safety. When your brake is gone, you can use reverse as a brake. And when the low gear band is worn too thin to pull up a steep hill, why, you can turn around and back up it. Gay found there was plenty of reverse, and he knew everything was all right. It was a good omen that Eddie came back with the dry cells without trouble. Mrs. Gay had been in the kitchen. Eddie could hear her walking about, but she didn't hear Eddie. He was very good at such things. Gay connected the dry cells, and he advanced the gas and retarded the spark lever. "Twist her tail," he said. He was such a wonder, Gay was. The little mechanic of God. The St. Francis of all things that turn and twist and explode. The St. Francis of coils and armatures and gears. And if at some time all the heaps of jalopies, cut-down Duesenbergs, Buicks, DeSotos and Plymouths, American Austins and Isotta Fraschinis, praise God in a great chorus, it will be largely due to Gay and his brotherhood. One twist, one little twist, and the engine caught, and labored, and faltered, and caught again. Gay advanced the spark and reduced the gas. He switched over to the magneto, and the Ford of Lee Chong chuckled and jiggled and clattered happily, as though it knew it was working for a man who loved and understood it. There were two small technical legal difficulties with the truck. It had no recent license plates, and it had no lights. But the boys hung a rag permanently and accidentally on the rear plate to conceal its vintage, and they dabbed the front plate with good thick mud. The equipment of the expedition was slight, some long-handled frog nets and some gunny sacks. City hunters going out for sport load themselves with food and liquor, but not Mac. He presumed rightly that the country was where food came from. Two loaves of bread and what was left of Eddie's wining jug was all the supply. The party clambered on the truck. Gay drove and Mac sat beside him. They bumped around the corner of Lee Chong's and down through the lot, threading among the pipes. Mr. Malloy waved at them from his seat by the boiler. Gay eased across the sidewalk and down off the curb gently, because the front tire showed fabric all the way around. With all their alacrity, it was afternoon when they got started. The truck eased into Red Williams' service station. Mac got out and gave his paper to Red. He said, "Doc was a little short of change, so if you put 5 gallons in and just give us a buck instead of the other 5 gallons, why, that's what Doc wants. He had to go south, you know. Had a big deal down there." Red smiled good-naturedly. "You know, Mac," he said, "Doc got to figuring if there was some kind of loophole, and he put his finger on the same one you did. Doc's a pretty bright fella, so he phoned me last night." "Put in the whole 10 gallons, said Mac. "No, wait. It'll slop around and spill. Put in 5 and give us 5 in a can, one of them sealed cans." Red smiled happily. "Doc kind of figured that one, too," he said. "Put in 10 gallons, said Mac, "and don't go leaving none in the hose." The little expedition did not go through the center of Monterey. a delicacy about the license plates and lights made Gay choose back streets. There would be the time when they would go up Carmel Hill and down into the valley, a good 4 miles on a main highway, exposed to any passing cop until they turned up the fairly unfrequented Carmel Valley Road. Gay chose a back street that brought them out on the main highway at Peter's Gate, just before the steep Carmel Hill starts. Gay took a good, noisy, clattering run at the hill, and in 50 yards he put the pedal down to low. He knew it wouldn't work. The band was worn too thin. On the level it was all right, but not on a hill. He stopped, let the truck back around, and aimed it down the hill. Then he gave it the gas and the reverse pedal, and the reverse was not worn. The truck crawled steadily and slowly, but backward, up Carmel Hill. And they very nearly made it. The radiator boiled, of course, but most Model T experts believe that it wasn't working well if it wasn't boiling. Someone should write an erudite essay on the moral, physical, and aesthetic effect of the Model T Ford on the American nation. 2 generations of Americans knew more about the Ford coil than the clitoris, about the planetary system of gears than the solar system of stars. With the Model T, part of the concept of private property disappeared. Pliers ceased to be privately owned, and a tire pump belonged to the last man who had picked it up. Most of the babies of the period were conceived in Model T Fords, and not a few were born in them. The theory of the Anglo-Saxon home became so warped that it never quite recovered. The truck backed sturdily up Carmel Hill, and it got past the Jack's Peak Road and was just going into the last and steepest pull when the motor's breathing thickened, gulped, and strangled. It seemed very quiet when the motor was still. Gay, who was heading downhill anyway, ran down the 50 feet and turned into the Jack's Peak Road entrance. "What is it?" Mac asked. "Carburetor, I think," said Gay. The engine sizzled and creaked with heat, and the jet of steam that blew down the overflow pipe sounded like the hiss of an alligator. The carburetor of a Model T is not complicated, but it needs all of its parts to function. There's a needle valve, and the point must be on the needle and must sit in its hole, or the carburetor does not work. Gay held the needle in his hand, and the point was broken off. "How in hell you suppose that happened?" he asked. "Magic," said Mac. "Just pure magic. Can you fix it?" "Hell no," said Gay. "Gotta get another one." "How much they cost?" "About $1 if you buy one new, quarter at a wrecker's." "You got $1? Mac asked. "Yeah, but I won't need it." "Well, get back as soon as you can, will you? We'll just stay right here." "Anyways, you won't go running off without a needle valve," said Gay. He stepped out to the road. He thumbed 3 cars before one stopped for him. The boys watched him climb in and start down the hill. They didn't see him again for 180 days. Oh, the infinity of possibility. How could it happen that the car that picked up Gay broke down before it got into Monterey? If Gay had not been a mechanic, he would not have fixed the car. If he had not fixed it, the owner wouldn't have taken him to Jimmy Brucia's for a drink. And why was it Jimmy's birthday? Out of all the possibilities in the world, the millions of them, only events occurred that led to the Salinas jail. Sparky Anea and Tiny Coletti had made up a quarrel and were helping Jimmy celebrate his birthday. The blonde came in. The musical argument in front of the jukebox. Gay's new friend, who knew a judo hold and tried to show it to Sparky, got his wrist broken when the hold went wrong. The policeman, with a bad stomach, all unrelated, irrelevant details, and yet all running in one direction. Fate just didn't intend Gay to go on that frog hunt, and fate took a hell of a lot of trouble and people and accidents to keep him from it. When the final climax came with the front of Holman's bootery broken out and the party trying on the shoes in the display window, only Gay didn't hear the fire whistle. Only Gay didn't go to the fire, and when the policemen came, they found him sitting all alone in Holman's window, wearing one brown Oxford and one patent leather dress shoe with a gray cloth top. Back at the truck, the boys built a little fire when it got dark and the chill crept up from the ocean. The pines above them soughed in the fresh sea wind. The boys lay in the pine needles and looked at the lonely sky through the pine branches. For a while, they spoke of the difficulties Gay must be having getting a needle valve. And then, gradually, as the time passed, they didn't mention him any more. "Somebody should have gone with him," said Mac. About 10 o'clock, Eddie got up. "There's a construction camp a piece up the hill," he said. "I think I'll go up and see if they got any Model T's." Chapter 12. Monterey is a city with a long and brilliant literary tradition. It remembers with pleasure and some glory that Robert Louis Stevenson lived there. Treasure Island certainly has the topography and the coastal plan of Point Lobos. More recently in Carmel, there have been a great number of literary men about, but there is not the old flavor, the old dignity of the true belle lettre. Once the town was greatly outraged over what the citizens considered a slight to an author. It had to do with the death of Josh Billings, the great humorist. Where the new post office is, there used to be a deep gulch with water flowing in it and a little footbridge over it. On one side of the gulch was a fine old adobe, and on the other the house of the doctor who handled all the sickness, birth, and death in the town. He worked with animals, too, and, having studied in France, he even dabbled in the new practice of embalming bodies before they were buried. Some of the old-timers considered this sentimental, and some thought it wasteful, and to some it was sacrilegious, since there was no provision for it in any sacred volume. But the better and richer families were coming to it, and it looked to become a fad. One morning, elderly Mr. Carriaga was walking from his house on the hill down toward Alvarado Street. He was just crossing the footbridge when his attention was drawn to a small boy and a dog struggling up out of the gulch. The boy carried a liver, while the dog dragged yards of intestine at the end of which a stomach dangled. Mr. Carriaga paused and addressed the little boy politely. "Good morning." In those days, little boys were courteous. "Good morning, sir." "Where are you going with the liver?" "I'm going to make some chum and catch some mackerel." Mr. Carriaga smiled. "And the dog, will he catch mackerel too?" "The dog found that. It's his, sir. We found them in the gulch." Mr. Carriaga smiled and strolled on, and then his mind began to work. "That isn't a beef liver, it's too small. And it isn't a calf's liver, it's too red. It isn't a sheep's liver." Now his mind was alert. At the corner he met Mr. Ryan. "Anyone die in Monterey last night?" he asked.
"Not that I know of," said Mr. Ryan.
"Anyone killed?"
"No."
They walked on together, and Mr. Carriaga told about the little boy and the dog. At the adobe bar, a number of citizens were gathered for their morning conversation. There, Mr. Carriaga told his story again, and he had just finished when the constable came into the adobe. He should know if anyone had died.
No one died in Monterey, he said, but Josh Billings died out at the Hotel Del Monte.
The men in the bar were silent, and the same thought went through all their minds. Josh Billings was a great man, a great writer. He had honored Monterey by dying there, and he had been degraded. Without much discussion, a committee formed made up of everyone there. The stern men walked quickly to the gulch and across the footbridge, and they hammered on the door of the doctor who had studied in France. He had worked late. The knocking got him out of bed and brought him tousled of hair and beard to the door in his nightgown. Mr. Carriaga addressed him sternly. "Did you embalm Josh Billings?"
"Why, yes."
"What did you do with his tripas?"
"Why, I threw them in the gulch, where I always do."
They made him dress quickly then, and they hurried down to the beach. If the little boy had gone quickly about his business, it would have been too late. He was just getting into a boat when the committee arrived. The intestine was in the sand where the dog had abandoned it. Then the French doctor was made to collect the parts. He was forced to wash them reverently and pick out as much sand as possible. The doctor himself had to stand the expense of the leaden box which went into the coffin of Josh Billings, for Monterey was not a town to let dishonor come to a literary man.
Chapter 13. Mac and the boys slept peacefully on the pine needles. Sometime before dawn, Eddie came back. He had gone a long way before he found a Model T, and then, when he did, he wondered whether or not it would be a good idea to take the needle out of its seat. It might not fit. So he took the whole carburetor. The boys didn't wake up when he got back. He lay down beside them and slept under the pine trees. There was one nice thing about Model T's. The parts were not only interchangeable, they were unidentifiable. There is a beautiful view from the Carmel grade, the curving bay with the waves creaming on the sand, the dune country around Seaside, and right at the bottom of the hill, the warm intimacy of the town. Mac got up in the dawn and hustled his pants where they bound him, and he stood looking down on the bay. He could see some of the purse seiners coming in. A tanker stood over against Seaside, taking on oil. Behind him, the rabbits stirred in the bush. Then the sun came up and shook the night chill out of the air the way you'd shake a rug. When he felt the first sun warmth, Mac shivered. The boys ate a little bread while Eddie installed the new carburetor, and when it was ready, they didn't bother to crank it. They pushed it out to the highway and coasted in gear until it started. And then, Eddie driving, they backed up over the rise, over the top, and turned and headed forward and down past Hatton Fields. In Carmel Valley, the artichoke plants stood gray-green, and the willows were lush along the river. They turned left up the valley. Luck blossomed from the first. A dusty Rhode Island red rooster, who had wandered too far from his own farmyard, crossed the road, and Eddie hit him without running too far off the road. Sitting in the back of the truck, Hazel picked him as they went and let the feathers fly from his hand, the most widely distributed evidence on record, for there was a little breeze in the morning blowing down from Jamesburg, and some of the red chicken feathers were deposited on Point Lobos, and some even blew out to sea. The Carmel is a lovely little river. It isn't very long, but in its course it has everything a river should have. It rises in the mountains and tumbles down a while, runs through shallows, is dammed to make a lake, spills over the dam, crackles among round boulders, wanders lazily under sycamores, spills into pools where trout live, drops in against banks where crayfish live. In the winter,
It becomes a torrent, a mean little fierce river, and in the summer it is a place for children to wade in and for fishermen to wander in. Frogs blink from its banks, and the deep ferns grow beside it. Deer and foxes come to drink from it secretly in the morning and evening, and now and then a mountain lion, crouched flat, laps its waters. The farms of the rich little valley back up to the river and take its water for the orchards and the vegetables. The quail call beside it, and the wild doves come whistling in at dusk. Raccoons pace its edges looking for frogs. It's everything a river should be. A few miles up the valley, the river cuts in under a high cliff from which vines and ferns hang down. At the base of this cliff, there is a pool, green and deep, and on the other side of the pool, there is a little sandy place where it's good to sit and to cook your dinner. Mac and the boys came down to this place happily. It was perfect. If frogs were available, they would be here. It was a place to relax, a place to be happy. On the way out, they had thriven. In addition to the big red chicken, there was a sack of carrots, which had fallen from a vegetable truck, half a dozen onions, which had not. Mac had a bag of coffee in his pocket. In the truck, there was a 5-gallon can with the top cut off. The whining jug was nearly half full. Such things as salt and pepper had been brought. Mac and the boys would have thought anyone who traveled without salt, pepper, and coffee very silly indeed. Without effort, confusion, or much thought, 4 round stones were rolled together on the little beach. The rooster, who had challenged the sunrise of this very day, lay dismembered and clean in water in the 5-gallon can, with peeled onions about him, while a little fire of dead willow sticks sputtered between the stones, a very little fire. Only fools build big fires. It would take a long time to cook this rooster, for it had taken him a long time to achieve his size and muscularity. But as the water began to boil gently about him, he smelled good from the beginning. Mac gave them a pep talk. "The best time for frogs is at night," he said, "so I guess we'll just lay around till it gets dark." They sat in the shade, and gradually, one by one, they stretched out and slept. Mac was right. Frogs do not move around much in the daytime. They hide under ferns, and they look secretly out of holes under rocks. The way to catch frogs is with a flashlight at night. The men slept, knowing they might have a very active night. Hazel stuck his pocket knife into the muscles of the chicken. There is no golden afternoon next to the cliff. When the sun went over it at about 2 o'clock, a whispering shade came to the beach. The sycamores rustled in the afternoon breeze. Little water snakes slipped down to the rocks and then gently entered the water and swam along through the pool, their heads held up like little periscopes and a tiny wake spreading behind them. A big trout jumped in the pool. The gnats and mosquitoes, which avoid the sun, came out and buzzed over the water. All of the sunbugs, the flies, the dragonflies, the wasps, the hornets, went home. And as the shadow came to the beach, as the first quail began to call, Mac and the boys awakened. The smell of the chicken stew was heartbreaking. Hazel had picked a fresh bay leaf from a tree by the river, and he had dropped it in. The carrots were in now. Coffee in its own can was simmering on its own rock, far enough from the flame so that it did not boil too hard. Mac awakened, started up, stretched, staggered to the pool, washed his face with cupped hands, hacked, spat, washed out his mouth, broke wind, tightened his belt, scratched his legs, combed his wet hair with his fingers, drank from the jug, belched, and sat down by the fire. "By God, that smells good," he said. Men all do about the same things when they wake up. Mac's process was loosely the one all of them followed, and soon they had all come to the fire and complimented Hazel. Hazel stuck his pocket knife into the muscles of the chicken. "He ain't going to be what you'd call tender," said Hazel. "You'd have to cook him about 2 weeks to get him tender. How old about do you judge he was, Mac?"
"I'm 48, and I ain't as tough as he is," said Mac.
Eddie said, "How old can a chicken get, do you think? That's if nobody pushes him around or he don't get sick."
"That's something nobody isn't ever going to find out," said Jones. It was a pleasant time. The jug went around and warmed them. Jones said, "Eddie, I don't mean to complain none. I was just thinking, suppose you had two or three jugs back of the bar. Suppose you put all the whiskey in one, and all the wine in another, and all the beer in another."
A slightly shocked silence followed the suggestion. "I didn't mean nothing," said Jones quickly. "I like it this way."
Jones talked too much then, because he knew he had made a social blunder and he wasn't able to stop.
"What I like about it this way is you never know what kind of drunk you're going to get out of it," he said. "You take whiskey," he said hurriedly. "You more or less know what you'll do. A fighting guy fights, and a crying guy cries. But this," he said magnanimously, "why, you don't know whether it'll run you up a pine tree or start you swimming to Santa Cruz. It's more fun that way," he said weakly.
"Speaking of swimming," said Mac, to fill in the indelicate place in the conversation and to shut Jones up, "I wonder whatever happened to that guy McKinley Moran. Remember that deep-sea diver?"
"I remember him," said Huey. "I and him used to hang around together. He just didn't get much work, and then he got to drinking. It's kind of tough on you, diving and drinking. Got to worrying, too. Finally, he sold his suit and helmet and pump, went on a hell of a drunk, and then he left town. I don't know where he went. He wasn't no good after he went down after that wop that got took down with the anchor from the 12 brothers. McKinley just dove down, bust his eardrums, and he wasn't no good after that. Didn't hurt the wop a bit."
Mac sampled the jug again. "He used to make a lot of dough during Prohibition," Mac said. "Used to get 25 bucks a day from the government to dive looking for liquor on the bottom, and he got $3 a case from Louis for not finding it. Had it worked out so he brought up one case a day to keep the government happy. Louis didn't mind that none. Made it so they didn't get in no new divers. McKinley made a lot of dough, though."
"Yeah," said Huey, "but he's like everybody else. Gets some dough and he wants to get married. He got married 3 times before his dough ran out. I could always tell. He'd buy a white fox fur piece and bang, next thing you know, he's married."
"I wonder what happened to Gay," Eddie asked. It was the first time they had spoken of him.
"Same thing, I guess," said Mac. "You just can't trust a married guy. No matter how much he hates his old lady, why, he'll go back to her. Get to thinking and brooding, and back he'll go. You can't trust him no more."
"Take Gay," said Mac. "His old lady hits him. But I'll bet you when Gay's away from her 3 days, he gets it figured out that it's his fault, and he goes back to make it up to her."
They ate long and daintily, spearing out pieces of chicken, holding the dripping pieces until they cooled, and then gnawing the muscled meat from the bone. They speared the carrots on pointed willow switches, and finally they passed the can and drank the juice, and around them the evening crept in as delicately as music. The quail called each other down to the water, the trout jumped in the pool, and the moths came down and fluttered about the pool as the daylight mixed into the darkness. They passed the coffee can about, and they were warm and fed and silent. At last Mac said,
"God damn it, I hate a liar."
"Who's been lying to you?" Eddie asked.
Oh, I don't mind a guy that tells a little one to get along or to hop up a conversation, but I hate a guy that lies to himself.
Who done that? Eddie asked.
Me, said Mac. And maybe you guys. Here we are, he said earnestly, the whole goddamn shabby lot of us. We worked it out that we wanted to give Doc a party. So we come out here and have a hell of a lot of fun, then we'll go back and get the dough from Doc. There's five of us, so we'll drink five times as much liquor as he will, and I ain't sure we're doing it for Doc. I ain't sure we ain't doing it for ourselves. And Doc's too nice a fella to do that to. Doc is the nicest fella I ever knew. I don't want to be the kind of guy that'd take advantage of him. You know, one time I put the bee on him for a buck. I gave him a hell of a story. Right in the middle, I seen he knew goddamn well the story was so much malarkey. So right in the middle, I says, Doc, that's a fucking lie. And he put his hand in his pocket and brought out a buck. Mac, he says, I figure a guy that needs it bad enough to make up a lie to get it really needs it. And he give me the buck. I paid him that buck back the next day. Never did spend it. Just kept it overnight and then give it back to him. Hazel said, There ain't nobody likes a party better than Doc. We're giving him the party. What the hell's the beef? I don't know, said Mac. I'd just like to give him something when I didn't get most of it back. How about a present? Huey suggested. Suppose we just bought the whiskey and give it to him and let him do what he wants. Now you're talking, said Mac. That's just what we'll do. We'll just give him the whiskey and fade out. You know what'll happen, said Eddie. Henri and them people from Carmel will smell that whiskey out, and then instead of only five of us, there'll be 20. Doc told me one time himself they can smell him frying a steak from Cannery Row clear down to Point Sur. I don't see the percentage. He'd come out better if we give him the party ourselves. Mac considered this reasoning. Maybe you're right, he said at last. But suppose we give him something except whiskey, maybe cufflinks with his initials. Oh, horse shit, said Hazel. Doc don't want stuff like that. The night was in by now, and the stars were white in the sky. Hazel fed the fire and put a little room of light on the beach. Over the hill a fox was barking sharply, and now in the night the smell of sage came down from the hills. The water chuckled on the stones where it went out of the deep pool. Mac was mulling over the last piece of reasoning when the sound of footsteps on the ground made him turn. A man dark and large stalked near, and he had a shotgun over his arm and a pointer walked shyly and delicately at his heel. "What the hell are you doing here?" he asked. "Nothing," said Mac. "The land's posted. No fishing, hunting, fires, camping. Now you just pack up and put that fire out and get off this land." Mac stood up humbly. "I didn't know, Captain," he said. "Honest, we never seen the sign, Captain." "There's signs all over. You couldn't have missed 'em." "Look, Captain, we made a mistake and we're sorry," said Mac. He paused and looked closely at the slouching figure. "You're a military man, aren't you, sir? I can always tell. Military man don't carry his shoulders the same as ordinary people. I was in the army so long, I can always tell." Imperceptibly, the shoulders of the man straightened. Nothing obvious, but he held himself differently. "I don't allow fires on my place," he said. "Well, we're sorry," said Mac. "We'll get right out, Captain. You see, we're working for some scientists. We're trying to get some frogs. They're working on cancer, and we're helping out getting some frogs." The man hesitated for a moment. "What do they do with the frogs?" he asked. "Well, sir," said Mac, "they give cancer to the frogs, and then they can study and experiment, and they got it nearly licked if they can just get some frogs.
But if you don't want us on your land, Captain, we'll get right out. Never would have come in if we knew.
Suddenly, Mac seemed to see the pointer for the first time.
By God, that's a fine-looking bitch, he said enthusiastically. She looks like Nola that win the field trials in Virginia last year. She a Virginia dog, Captain?
The captain hesitated, and then he lied.
Yes, he said shortly. She's lame. Tick got her right on her shoulder.
Mac was instantly solicitous.
Mind if I look, Captain? Come, girl. Come on, girl.
The pointer looked up at her master and then sidled up to Mac.
Pile on some twigs so I can see, he said to Hazel.
It's up where she can't lick it, said the captain, and he leaned over Mac's shoulder to look. Mac pressed some pus out of the evil-looking crater on the dog's shoulder.
I had a dog head a thing like this, and it went right in and killed him. She's just had pups, didn't she?
Yes, said the captain. Six. I put iodine on that place.
No, said Mac, that won't draw. You got any Epsom salts up at your place?
Yes, there's a big bottle.
Well, you make a hot poultice of Epsom salts and put it on there. She's weak, you know, from the pups. Be a shame if she got sick now. You'd lose the pups, too.
The pointer looked deep into Mac's eyes, and then she licked his hand.
Tell you what I'll do, Captain. I'll look after her myself. Epsom salt'll do the trick. That's the best thing.
The captain stroked the dog's head.
You know, I've got a pond up by the house that's so full of frogs I can't sleep nights. Why don't you look up there? They bellow all night. I'd be glad to get rid of them.
That's mighty nice of you, said Mac. I'll bet those docs would thank you for that. But I'd like to get a poultice on this dog.
He turned to the others.
You put out this fire, he said. Make sure there ain't a spark left and clean up around. You don't want to leave no mess. I and the captain'll go and take care of Nola here. You fellows follow along when you get cleared up.
Mac and the captain walked away together. Hazel kicked sand on the fire.
I bet Mac could have been president of the U.S. if he wanted, he said.
What could he do with it if he had it? Jones asked. There wouldn't be no fun in that.
Chapter 14. Early morning is a time of magic in Cannery Row. In the gray time after the light has come and before the sun has risen, the row seems to hang suspended out of time in a silvery light. The street lights go out, and the weeds are a brilliant green. The corrugated iron of the canneries glows with a pearly lucence of platinum or old pewter. No automobiles are running then. The street is silent of progress and business, and the rush and drag of the waves can be heard as they splash in among the piles of the canneries. It's a time of great peace, a deserted time, a little era of rest. Cats drip over the fences and slither like syrup over the ground to look for fish heads. Silent early morning dogs parade majestically, picking and choosing judiciously whereon to pee. The seagulls come flapping in to sit on the cannery roofs to await the day of refuse. They sit on the roof peaks shoulder to shoulder. From the rocks near the Hopkins Marine Station comes the barking of sea lions like the baying of hounds. The air is cool and fresh. In the back gardens, the gophers push up the morning mounds of fresh, damp earth, and they creep out and drag flowers into their holes. Very few people are about, just enough to make it seem more deserted than it is. One of Dora's girls comes home from a call on a patron too wealthy or too sick to visit the bear flag. Her makeup is a little sticky, and her feet are tired. Lee Chong brings the garbage cans out and stands them on the curb. The old Chinaman comes out of the sea and flap flaps across the street and up past the palace. The cannery watchman
look out and blink at the morning light. The bouncer at the bear flag steps out on the porch in his shirt sleeves and stretches and yawns and scratches his stomach. The snores of Mr. Malloy's tenants in the pipes have a deep, tunnely quality. It is the hour of the pearl, the interval between day and night when time stops and examines itself. On such a morning, and in such a light, two soldiers and two girls strolled easily along the street. They had come out of La Ida, and they were very tired and very happy. The girls were hefty, big-breasted and strong, and their blonde hair was in slight disarray. They wore printed rayon party dresses, wrinkled now and clinging to their convexities, and each girl wore a soldier's cap, one far back on her head, and the other with the visor down almost on her nose. They were full-lipped, broad-nosed, hippie girls, and they were very tired.
The soldiers' tunics were unbuttoned, and their belts were threaded through their epaulets. The ties were pulled down a little so the shirt collars could be unbuttoned, and the soldiers wore the girls' hats, one a tiny yellow straw boater with a bunch of daisies on the crown, the other a white knitted half hat to which medallion